So reading from 1 Corinthians 1:18 to 31. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made the foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs, and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord.
Thank you, Rebecca. Please turn to Isaiah in the Bibles. This is where we're going to be spending the next few moments of our time. Isaiah 53, verses 1 to 3. Isaiah 53, verse 1. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. I've mentioned before a survey that took place in 2006. I think it was done by the Daily Mail. It was a survey of primary school children, and they were asked, what's the most important thing in your life? What's the most important thing for you? What would you most like to be? And top answer in 2006 was being a celebrity. That was it, being a celebrity. And similar surveys were done around the same time, asking a similar question, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And when surveys like that have been done in the past, people would say, well, you know, astronaut or teacher or, you know, train driver or something like that. But this time when it was asked, at the top was pop star, sports star, film star. And that was 18 years ago. I don't think there's been any similar surveys done recently, but if there was, I'm sure that the growth of social media and the growth of reality TV, the explosion of reality TV, would mean that the answers are pretty much the same, even more magnified, probably. Kids want to be famous. They want to be a celebrity. They want to be noticed. They want to be liked. They want to be successful. They want to be well-known. They want to be a somebody in the eyes of the world and not a nobody. And it's not just kids, we grown-ups are the same, deep down, if we start exploring underneath. I remember being asked at a class at theological college, if you couldn't be you, who would you be? I can't remember the purpose of the question, but it was in a formal class, and we were meant to talk about this to each other. And I was sat next to a guy called Ian, and Ian said, I'd want to be Sting. Sting, obviously pop star. With the police, and he said, what about you, Paul? Who would you be if you couldn't be you? Straight away, no hesitation, I said, I want to be Elvis. I want to be Elvis. I want to be the king of rock and roll. And that's true. Deep down, I want to be liked. I want to be respected. I want to be thought well of. I want to be admired. I want to be accepted by people, not rejected. I want to be seen as brilliant, not average. I want to stand out from the crowd, not just blend in. I want to be thought wise, not stupid. And I think deep down, we all do. And that's a problem when it comes to being a servant of the Lord, because that's not the road the servant of the Lord walked down when he entered this world. So we're looking at this song in Isaiah about someone that God calls my servant, and the New Testament tells us exactly who it is. It's Jesus. And the big issue in Isaiah, remember we said last week, is the big issue in the world and the big issue in our lives, which is how can people who've rebelled against God their maker, who have hateful hearts towards him, how can we ever have peace with him? How can we be reconciled to him? How can people with dirty hearts in God's eyes, soiled hearts, soiled with our rebellion, ever be clean and fit for his presence and to serve him and to be at home with him one day in the perfect new world that he's bringing in? Is such a thing even possible? And the answer that the book of Isaiah gives and the Bible gives is yes, it is possible. Amazingly, astonishingly, it's possible. How? And God's equally astonishing answer is through my servant. Through my servant. And last time, in that first part of the song, we saw the servant's success. We heard God speaking. His servant will win. There is a good end to this story. He will be raised. He will be lifted up. He will be highly exalted. And he will sprinkle many nations. His work will be a success. He will save them. But the way he wins the victory is through this appalling suffering. Well, that's the good news of salvation that Isaiah is to preach, a mighty salvation powerfully brought about by the arm of the Lord. That's the phrase we see in verse 1, the arm of the Lord. The arm of the Lord is a phrase used elsewhere in the Bible to describe the mighty, powerful way that God saves his people from their enemies, particularly at the time of the Exodus, when God saved Israel from slavery. So God appears to Moses in Exodus 6, and he says, this is the message you're going to take to the Israelites. I will free you from being slaves to the Egyptians. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. And then there follows these kind of terrible plagues. God's mighty arm in judgment, rescuing his people. And then the next time the phrase appears in Exodus is at the waters of the Red Sea. God has brought the waters of the sea back down on the Egyptians as they pursued the Israelites. The Israelites are safe on the bank and they're singing this song and they see the Egyptian bodies floating in the sea and they say, this has happened by the power of your arm, Lord. The arm of the Lord always meant destruction, blood, judgment. So when Isaiah 52 verse 10, in the chapter before ours, promises a new Exodus is coming, a mighty salvation is coming, much bigger than the older Exodus. The last Exodus was big, but this is going to be even bigger. Verse 10, the Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. When we hear that, we're thinking, wow, a violent showdown's coming. God is coming powerfully to save his people in power, and here he is. The servant. Servant? Really? Yeah, not just a servant. A suffering servant. That's the arm of the Lord. That's the powerful arm of the Lord, we're being told. A servant who suffers. Really? Hard to believe. Which brings us to verse 1 in Isaiah's question, 53 verse 1. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? It's not the Lord speaking anymore, but those he's called to witness to the saving message about the servant, to witness to Israel, to witness to the world. And the expected answer to the question is no one. No one's believed. Because that was the ministry that God had given Isaiah. So back in chapter 6, God had said, Isaiah, you're going to go and preach to Israel. You're going to preach to Judah, what's left of Israel in the southern kingdom. And this is what you're going to say to them. Be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. There's a message of judgment. God saying, Isaiah, I'm sending you to this resistant, hard-hearted, rebellious people. They've persistently refused to believe in me, and your message will confirm them in their unbelief. The people of Judah will not be saved by your preaching. They'll be hardened by it. And that's what happened in Isaiah's day, as he preached the message of the coming servant. And it's what happened 700 years later when the servant finally arrived. God's people, Israel, refused to believe in him. Listen to how John starts his gospel. Apostle John says this of Jesus: he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. And then verses 1 to 3 of Isaiah they're the story of Jesus' life on earth. So verse 2, he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. Again, this takes us back to earlier in Isaiah when Isaiah says, chapter 6 and then chapter 10 and 11, that God is coming in judgment on Israel, and Israel's going to be decimated like a felled forest. So it's going to be this cutting down of Israel, and all that's left is going to be stumps. But out of this dry, desolate, ruined landscape, hope will spring. A shoot will appear on one of those stumps, the stump of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of King David. So out of King David's family, what's left of that family, and there's not much left when Isaiah's preaching, a new king will spring up, and God's Spirit will be on him, and he will establish a glorious, eternal kingdom of peace and of justice, and he will reign forever. And here he is, Isaiah 53, verse 2. Here he is growing up, a shoot, but it's small, tender, a tender shoot. That means it's weak, fragile, vulnerable, delicate. And that was Jesus, wasn't it? An embryo in a teenage peasant girl's womb. A boy laid in a manger, tiny baby in a manger. A toddler on the run with his parents from a powerful tyrant who wants to kill him. A refugee child in Egypt. Small, weak, fragile, vulnerable. And then a root out of dry ground. Unpromising beginnings, that means. Dry ground. Unpromising. A baby in a manger. It's pretty unpromising. A boy growing up in Nowheresville. Nazareth. That was Nowheresville back then. Place people looked down on, despised. Backwater, like Barrow. Today, we'd say. That's our problem, looking down on Barrow like that. But that's how people see it. And that's how people saw Nazareth. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. It's not saying he was ugly. It's just ordinary, average. It was like everybody else. Someone you'd just walk past on the street and you wouldn't notice them particularly. You wouldn't pay much attention to them. Unimpressive. The mighty arm of the Lord. Really? Is this the best that God can do for us? And so they rejected him. Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by mankind. And that's why there was no room for him in Bethlehem when he was born. You see, the girl wasn't married. And there were those rumors that the carpenter wasn't the father. And as a man, when he started to preach that God's kingdom had come and that he was the king, the people in his hometown, they took offense. They ran him out of town. They took him to a cliff. They're going to throw him off a cliff. His family, well, they think he's crazy. The religious leaders of the day think he's from the devil. And then there's the time in John 6, just after he's done this amazing miracle, he's fed this vast crowd with next to nothing. And then he tells the people what it means. This is what it means. I am the bread of life, Jesus says. And I've come from God, from heaven. God sent me to raise the dead. And when they hear this, the Jews, John 6, verse 41, began to grumble about him because he said, I am the bread that came down from heaven. They said, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, I've come down from heaven? What's special about him? He made a coffee table for my mother-in-law. He made a stool for my granddad. He's common as dirt. He's just one of us. There's nothing special about him. He's just the son of Joseph. Who does he think he is? Saying stuff like that. And then in the next chapter, John 7, we read that even his own brothers would not believe in him. And then in John 11, he's just raised a man from the dead, Lazarus. And when they see this, the religious leaders decide, right, we're going to kill him. They plot to take his life. And then in John 12, we're told this. Listen to this. John says, even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet. Lord, who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Isaiah 53, verse 1. They didn't believe, just like Isaiah said. And so they despised and they rejected him and they hurt him. He was a man of suffering and familiar with pain, betrayed into the hands of his enemies by a very close friend, abandoned by his disciples, running away, deserting him in his hour of greatest need, falsely accused and condemned as a blasphemer at a rigged trial, sentenced to a criminal's death, dressed in a scarlet robe, crown of thorns on his head, mocked by the soldiers, spat on, beaten with sticks, laid on a wooden stake, nails driven through his hands and his feet, hoisted up naked in public view, and cruelly mocked as he died there. Mocked. I mean, you've really got to despise someone to mock them as they die that horrific, torturous death, don't you? You've got to really despise them to mock them when they're going through that. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised. Like the homeless, toothless addicts that ask you for money outside the bank and you pretend you haven't seen them. Embarrassed. And that was Jesus, shunned by the important people, an embarrassment to his friends, to those who claimed to be his friends. We held him in low esteem, is how verse 3 ends. We held him in low esteem. We. Not just those other people over there. We. Isaiah's including himself. We added up what we thought that he amounted to, and we gave him zero. And that's how much we're at war with God. Human beings, yeah. He enters the world as one of us to sprinkle us, to save us, to wash us clean, and we don't give him the time of day. He comes to be with us. He comes to be one of us in our weak humanity to save us, and we use that to fight against him. He's just one of us. Who does he think he is? He's nothing special. We've all treated Jesus this way. I can remember a time when he really was irrelevant to me. It didn't matter to me, not worth much of a thought. When he was presented to me in a talk or a sermon, I grew up in a Christian home, when he was presented to me in a talk or a Bible study, I was just indifferent to him. I was bored with him. A man on a cross 2,000 years ago? Well, long time ago. What's that got to do with anything? Not really interested. Not exciting. Not impressive. There were times when I laughed at him, joined the mockers in their spiritual spiteful taunts, telling jokes about Jesus on the cross, laughing at those sick jokes. That was me, using his name as a curse, just holding him in low esteem, despising him, rejecting him. Or maybe you can remember similar things in your life, or even today, a turning away from Jesus in anger or fear. And, you know, we still do it, don't we, after we've become Christians. We say or we sing that we hold him in high esteem when often we hold him in low esteem in practice. So whenever we've disobeyed his words, whenever we haven't been bothered to think about him, when we've been embarrassed of him, when we've been ashamed to stand out as his people, silent when we've had an opportunity's come up to speak to someone else about him, and so we've remained silent because we know that it's not going to be popular. The world despises Jesus. The world rejects Jesus. The message of this sovereign servant is offensive. It's foolish. It's weak, unimpressive, irrelevant, shameful, ugly, vulgar, simple in the world's eyes. And the temptation of the church and the temptation of Christians is to stay quiet or change the message, make it more attractive, make it more entertaining, make it more sophisticated, more impressive, acceptable to the 21st century world. And many churches have gone down that road. And that's what was happening at Corinth in the church there. That's the first reading that Rebecca read to us. They're trying to make an impact in Corinth. And they think they're never going to take a message about a man dying on a cross. So we've got to change it. So they're taking the cross out of the message. And the Apostle Paul writes to them and says, don't do it. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, yes. But to those who are being saved, it's the power of God. Don't lose the power. The message of the cross is the way that God rolls up his sleeve and he bares his holy arm to save the world powerfully. And that's true. The message of the cross, the message of the suffering servant, opens our blind eyes. And that's what the servant song tells us. So again, verse 1, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Now, answer, on one level, as we've seen, not many people. Not many. Certainly not many in Israel. But on another level, the answer is many. Remember verse 15 of 52. Many nations will be sprinkled. Many will be saved by the servant. Many will see. Many will understand the truth about him. How? It will be revealed to them, verse 1. And now by nature, we can't see the servant. We're spiritually blind, and we won't see him unless he's revealed to us. But the arm of the Lord is so strong that he does that. He opens blind eyes. He breaks into hard hearts. He gives understanding to dull minds. How does he do that? Through our message. That's the answer, through the message, through the good news message of the servant who suffers to save his people. That's God's power to reveal. That's God's power to save. That's how he does his most mighty work of gathering a people for himself from all the nations of the world, through preaching of a message about a rejected, despised man dying on a cross in weakness and shame. That's how he saved you. And that was the testimony that we heard a couple of Sundays ago at the baptism service, wasn't it? It's four people baptized. Brilliant to hear. Each and every one was saying that what saved them was that message of the cross. Jesus died for them. That's what brought them to that point of baptism. Here's Tom's testimony. Probably don't mind me reading it out again, Tom. It's good to see you this morning. But if you were there, you remember Tom says he put his faith in Jesus during a conversation with Joel last year. It was the Christianity Explore course. At the time, he was skeptical about Christianity, challenging Christianity, trying to poke holes in the gospel. He didn't believe there was a God, certain that's what they were talking about at the time, this man dying on the cross to save us and saving us by pure gift. It was nonsense. And his question was, how was it fair that Jesus should take the punishment to forgive a murderer on death row? And Joel's answer was, that's the point. It's not fair. It's not fair for Jesus to take the punishment for anyone, but he did. And Tom says, in that moment, it all made sense. Everything suddenly clicked into place. He loves me. He's forgiven all my sins. He's willing to accept me, a sinner, into his kingdom. I finally understood the true meaning of grace. This revelation had a profound effect on my life. And then he went on to tell us. But how did Tom become a Christian? It was revealed to him. How was it revealed? Through the message of a man who suffered to save his people. Power is in the message. The message of the suffering servant is God's power to open our blind eyes. Next, the message of the suffering servant encourages us in our witness and our work. Jesus the King, the eternal Son of God, became a nobody in this world to save the world. And in his ongoing mission to the world, he loves to use nobodies. That's what he told the church in Corinth. He wants a church to reach out to this sophisticated, cosmopolitan, rich, impressive city. Who does he choose to do that? Listen to the list of people he chose. 1 Corinthians 1, people who are not wise by human standards, not influential, not of noble birth, foolish, the weak, the lowly, the despised, the nobodies. That's who he chose. The no-counts in the eyes of the world. Oh, that's so encouraging. It tells us it's okay to be weak. It's okay to be unimpressive. It's okay to be lowly. It's okay to be despised. We don't need a glitzy, glamorous church. We don't need to be celebrities. And we don't need the celebrities of our day to profess faith in Christ in order to make Jesus more attractive to the world. Sometimes we do that, don't we? You hear of a famous person becoming a Christian, and all of a sudden that person is paraded before the world. You're thinking, all we have to do is parade this person before the world, and the world will be impressed. Non-Christians will be impressed that this celebrity has become a Christian. And when we do that, it's as if Jesus isn't glorious and isn't attractive in himself. We just need to be the McDonald's workers. We just need to be the supermarket workers. We just need to be the farmers. We just need to be the teachers, the nurses, the doctors, the students, the stay-at-home mums, the care workers, the retired people that we are. obscure, ordinary, average, nobodies. We're the people God uses to love, loves to use. That's what I wanted to say. And does use. Who did God use to lead Tom to Jesus? Well, you kind of some funny Romanian guys who work in McDonald's. Yeah, Xavier and Diego. And pastor at Par Street Church, Joel. Joel, and I said this earlier, I haven't seen whether Joel minded or not, but he's just ordinary. Joel, ordinary Joel. Unimpressive in many ways. Where is he? Is he gone? Oh, there he is, here he goes. Thanks, Joel. But he is, because we all are. We all are. But that's who he uses. It is brilliant. Let's not be afraid to be a church like Jesus. Weak, lowly, despised, a nothing church of nobodies. That's who Jesus is going to use to get the glory. Thirdly, finally, the message of the suffering servant comforts us in our suffering. So you speak this message, you live this message, you're going to get into trouble. It'll bring you mockery, it'll bring you scorn, bring you rejection, it'll bring you persecution. Don't be surprised, therefore, when it happens. But when it does happen, remember you're in good company because that's how the world treated Jesus. And remember that this suffering is temporary and it leads to glory. That's the message of the suffering servant, isn't it? We saw that last week. Yes, he suffers, but there's a good ending, happy ending, raised, lifted up, highly exalted, glory. Temporary suffering, appalling suffering, temporary suffering, but leading to endless glory. And that's how it is for Jesus' people. There's a happy ending. It's temporary. Charles Simeon was a pastor in Cambridge back in the 18th century, 19th century. And he suffered terribly for his faithful proclamation of the cross in Cambridge. You can read all about it. I won't go into any details, but it's like he was there for over 50 years, and it was a nightmare. People opposed him, persecuted him. They locked the church against him. They got someone else to preach instead of him, the people of the congregation. And the people of the town hated him as well. They used to throw stones at him. Anyway, he kept going and didn't stop. And it was a fruitful work in the end. But at the end, he was asked by a friend how he'd managed to get through all that persecution and opposition and ridicule. And this is what he said. He said, "My dear friend, we must not mind a little suffering for Christ's sake. When I'm getting through a hedge, if my head and my shoulders are safely through, then I can bear the pricking of my legs. Let us rejoice in the remembrance that our holy head Jesus has surmounted all his suffering and he has triumphed over death. Let us follow him patiently, for we will soon be partakers of his victory." The other way that the message of the suffering servant comforts us in our suffering, and not just persecution, but also just our general suffering, our sicknesses, our relationship difficulties, our financial difficulties, all these things, is that Jesus was a man of sorrows who was acquainted with grief and pain. The truth of verse 3, it's been so precious to Christians down the ages. Suffering can be lonely, can't it? Maybe you're going through that at the minute. And one of the things we most need to know when we're suffering is to know that we're not alone in it, and also that the person with us understands something of what we're going through, empathizes, sympathizes. And that's what we have in Jesus. What a friend we have in Jesus. All our sins and griefs to bear. He knows what it is to live as a man. He knows what it is to be tired and to be weary. He knows what it is to be sad. He knows what it is to be heartbroken, to be grief-stricken, to lose somebody. He knows what it is to be hurt by friends, to be lied about. He knows what it is to be verbally abused. He knows what it is to be physically abused. He knows what it is to be blanked, to be belittled, and he knows what it is to die. And that makes him a sympathetic servant. First doctor to die of AIDS in the UK was a young Christian who contracted the virus while working in Zimbabwe. He was doing some medical research there, and he contracted the disease, and in his final days, he really declined. His powers of communication failed, began to desert him, so he couldn't express his thoughts, really struggled. And on one occasion, his wife just couldn't understand what he was trying to say. So the young guy, he took a notepad, and with a very faltering, weak hand, he just managed to write one letter, and that letter was J. And she was thinking, J, 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 what's he trying to say? And she ran through loads of words beginning with J, and none was right. And then she said, "Jesus." And he nodded. Jesus, that was the right word. That was the right person. Jesus was with them. Jesus understood. Jesus knew their pain and suffering and sorrow. And that's all that they needed to know, because that is always enough. Jesus, the sympathetic servant, always present, always sufficient for what we're facing. Someone like us, who we can turn to and talk to today. And if you're in the mire today, you can turn to him and you will find a sympathetic friend. And the message of the suffering servant also comforts us in our suffering, because it tells us that our suffering has a purpose. It is not meaningless. We live in a world that hates suffering, runs away from it, recoils at it, at all costs, even at the cost of taking your own life to avoid suffering. But Jesus' suffering had a purpose. It was to save us, and he can use our suffering for his glory, for our good, and for the good of others, to point others to his salvation. Think of a guy called Leslie. He was a young Christian I met quite a few years ago. He was visiting our church one Easter. He was very enthusiastic. I asked him what led him to follow Jesus, and this is what he said. He said, "It was my mum dying. My mum dying. She was a clear witness as she suffered and eventually died from this illness that she was suffering from. And he said her assurance, her peace, it just made me think Jesus must be real, and it made me open to hearing the truth about him. And I heard that truth, and I was saved." Don't despise our suffering, because we follow a suffering servant. So do we see the arm of the Lord powerfully working rescue for his people, just as he did in the Exodus, bringing destruction, blood, and judgment? Only this time, the destruction is that of sin. The blood is the blood of a sacrifice, and the judgment, well, the judgment's poured out on the only person who didn't deserve it, on Jesus the servant. And in that weak and shameful cross is a victory more powerful and more profound and more everlasting than any other. For on that cross, God bared his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and he ground sin, and he ground death, and he ground Satan into the dust once and for all. What a mighty, mighty Savior.